then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, put your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's February the 24th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom, tis the rising.
Okay, tell you what, this week I'm going to reverse the usual order of things, and I'm going to hold off on the emails for the first part of tonight's show so that I can get the grimly serious stuff out of the way first. I hope I'll be able to squeeze in a few of your emails at the end of tonight's broadcast as well. Tonight, I'm going to take the opportunity to talk about a number of those things that people keep telling me, no, Harold, you shouldn't discuss these things in public. But of course, that's exactly the kind of thing that we really do need to be talking about. Yes, I know, hostiles are listening, and if I had some way to speak only to the better element among you guys and block all the idiots from hearing me, I'd take it, but I don't. Yes, Harold is back on one of his character kicks again, and I'm going to say some things that need to be said so I can get them out of the way. This podcast can serve as my official canned answer or canned comment on some of these matters. From now on, anytime anybody asks about these things, I'll just tell them to listen to the Radio Free Northwest for February the 24th. I'm going to address some things that, so far as I'm aware, no other public personality in the movement is willing to talk about. That's another thing. From now on, I'm going to use that term public personality instead of leader, because we not only have no real leaders as yet, but more importantly, we have no followers. An internet writer or speaker is not a leader because he writes or speaks, not leads. An internet listener is not a follower because he or she listens, they don't follow. The fact is that there is virtually nothing about the internet that involves any real leadership of any kind. Now, these are activities that have to do with words, not physical acts. The production or consumption of words is not in any way a meaningful political or racial act unless the words result in physical activity in the real world in conformity with those words, if you get my drift. What we do have today is a small collection of public personalities who are prominent on the internet. Not just me, but guys like John DeNugent, Alex Jones, Jet and John, White Rabbit, Jamie Kelso, the Stormfront Gooboo crew, so forth and so on. We're not leaders, we're spiritual advisors at best, and mostly just entertainers. We don't have a movement because the term movement implies motion, and there's almost none of that. What we have is an audience that is probably overall in the area of about 100,000 people. If we combine all the podcasts and the V-Bulletin boards and the blogs, the whole enchilada. Now that's just an educated guess, and I may be off base on that figure, but not too far off, I don't think. Now, that's good. You know, we could win this with 100,000 people easy if only we could find some way to get those 100,000 out of the passive mode, out from behind their computers, and get them to commit at least a few basic physical real-world acts. And I'm not even talking about going out into a public square in a big mob like the Muslims are doing all over the Middle East right now. It needn't be anywhere that spectacular. I could list about 5 physical acts that would involve no lawbreaking, no risk, no relocation, and only a fairly small amount of expense and inconvenience. And if I could get all 100,000 white people in our overall internet audience to actually do those things, then we could still win and who knows, maybe even bring back Beaver Cleaverville and the Brady Bunch. But I can't get that 100,000 people to act. No one can. And that's why we've had to fall back on the Northwest Imperative of the Butler Plan, which needs only a minimum of 1,000 people who will act. A few more than that would be nice, of course, but we may not even be able to find that first 1,000. That's your department, not mine. Sorry, wandered off there for a bit. Where was I? I will refer tonight to the movement for the sake of clarity and convenience, because it's the term most of you are accustomed to. And also because, to be fair, there is some forward motion. Although it's confined to the Northwest Front and the Northwest Migration. No brag, folks, just fact. To the best of my knowledge, the NF is the only American movement faction where any physical activity at all is taking place, and that's in the form of a small trickle of people who finally are actually beginning to come here and form small communities. But it's happening way, way too slow. Kind of like those little drips of water in a cave that over the millennia will eventually wear down a big rock or a stalagmite to a nub. Unfortunately, the white race no longer has millennia to wait. What I want to talk about first tonight is burnout, and this is the time of year for burnout. But before I proceed on to the main rave of the evening, I need to lay a bit of a Grandpa Simpson digression on you. Now, back in the day, in those fabulous days of yesteryear, before the internet came along and the movement became a computer game, I learned the trade, if you want to call it that, from a guy named Matt Cale. Now, I had quite a few political and personal bones to pick with Cale at the time, and I still have a few bones to pick with Cale, none of which I'll get into, but I have to admit that now in my declining years, so to speak, I'm beginning to understand why Cale did some of the things he did and appreciate where he was coming from a bit more. Anyway, one of the things that Matt Cale taught me was that the white racial resistance movement is seasonal. Once you understand that, then you understand right away what a lot of our problem has been over the past 50 years. We're not using our heads, literally. We are operating on our moods and whims. It's become axiomatic that life in white America has become completely narcissistic and subjective. American life and culture is no longer about thought, it's about emotion. Pollsters no longer ask Americans what they think about anything. They ask, how do you feel about such and such? For a long time, the white nationalist movement has, for many of us, been a matter not of intellectual or moral certainty, not something that has to be done because it's the right thing to do, but it's been about our mood, about how we feel on that particular day. And with most white people, especially males, there are distinct ups and downs there. One day, a guy will be all fired up with inspiration and enthusiasm and ready to storm the barricades for the white race. Yeah, yeah, yeah! And the next day, he's all depressed because nobody will listen to him, and it's hard, and it's not all happening by magic. There's no way to fast forward the tape to the fun part. And he just wants to sit on the sofa, flipping the television remote and cracking one beer after another out of a six-pack, getting quietly plastered and feeling sorry for himself. For most white males, the down days outnumber the up days by a significant margin. Now, this state of mood swing has a very seasonal expression in movement people and movement terms. It seems to be connected, among other things, to the changing of the weather. Cale always sent out his twice-annual fund appeals for the old NSWPP in the spring and the fall, which is something I learned from him and a tradition I still follow myself, because it works. He once explained to me that the trick is to catch your potential donors right on the cusp of the change of seasons. When the spring sunshine finally melts all the snow and the slush, and it's warm out and people can finally go outside and enjoy a sunny day and blue skies again, and their mood shifts upwards. Cale actually used to listen to weather forecasts on the National Weather Service on a shortwave radio to try and predict when the exact change of season would occur in various parts of North America, and he would stagger his fund appeal mailings accordingly to try and catch the donors at exactly that right moment when they've had a couple of days of new weather to get them all out of their seasonal depression. Now, that bad period before that, January and February, what we're in now, is usually referred to by movement professionals, shall we say, as winter doldrums. January and February is a bad time. Christmas is over, the Christmas bills are coming in, people have to start working on their taxes, and worst of all, in most parts of the country, the weather is absolutely foul, and it makes all the sad sack white boys and middle-aged men slump down on their sofas with the six-packs and swill them down and stare at the TV feeling sorry for themselves. It needs a few good sunny days in spring to snap them out of it, and then for the next couple of months, things always pick up. Now, even now that we're almost all internet, I've noticed that the same pattern is there. But then comes what we call summer slump, July and August, when it gets so wretchedly hot over most parts of the country that most of the middle-aged racist couch potatoes just sort of lie on their sofas under the air conditioners like dogs in the shade, panting with their tongues hanging out, and with, of course, the same six-pack of beer. Now, by the way, Cale isn't the only one who instructed me back then on how this works. Major William Gadke once told me, quote-unquote, in July and August, you might as well just hang up a sign that says, gone fishing. Everybody always disappears, and then they wander back in after Labor Day. And it's true. A lot of our people really do disappear in January and February, and again in July and August, and they don't check in until after Labor Day. And the number of emails I've been getting was over 200 per day just before Christmas of this year. Now, I haven't counted lately, but I can tell you it's been way down, and it won't start picking up again until late March. It never does. Now, why is Harold rambling on and on about this uncomfortable and mildly embarrassing phenomenon? Because it cuts right to the root of why we have failed to build a bona fide revolutionary movement in this country for the past 50 years. And indeed, why nobody, right or left, has ever succeeded in building a successful revolutionary movement in North America since the days of the Reconstruction Klan. I'm not quite sure what to call this psychological phenomenon that would be completely accurate. SAD, maybe, seasonally affective disorder. SAWD, SAWD, seasonally affected white disorder. Dr. Pierce called it hobbyism, but I think it cuts a little bit deeper than that. It has to do with the deep strain of narcissism in American whites that convinces us that in the long run it's all about ourselves, that we are the true center of the universe, and that the entire movement and racial and political crisis exists only insofar as it affects us or interests us. Now, when we lose interest, then the whole issue, the whole crisis, no longer exists. And how can anything that doesn't exist affect us or anyone else, right? This is the kind of attitude that's necessary among people who are intended to be nothing but consumer animals, financial livestock to keep an economy going. And so that's what the Jews have made us. People who are concerned about issues and ideas and values larger than themselves always find things to do with their leisure time other than spending money on themselves, and we can't have that now, can we? You want to know the answer as to why white Americans will react in a proactive manner, shall we say, over things like sex and money and drugs, but when confronted with an unspeakable tyranny that seeks to erase our very species from existence, we sit on the sofa cracking those beers and flipping the remote? It's because sex and drugs and money affect or involve us personally. Our desires, our greed, our lust, our hurt pride, our egos, so forth and so on. Now, those things are worth shooting somebody or taking some other kind of action over. Because that's my money, that's my dope, that's my girl who's slutting around on me. My ride that got trashed, you get the picture. Anything that does not affect a white American's own welfare or appetites or ego directly, or in some cases that of an immediate family member, doesn't exist for us. I don't think there's ever been a time in history when human beings had such a completely narrowed and restricted view of the universe, a universe that centers around us alone as individuals, with no real loyalty to any group of people, never mind any entity or idea larger than ourselves. Oh, sure, there have always been egomaniacs like Caligula and Benvenuto Cellini and Beau Brummel. But the Jews have created a whole culture in this country where only they are mentally and emotionally capable of seeing longer than 10 minutes ahead or 10 inches in front of our face. Now, this is one of the many crimes that the Jewish people have committed against the rest of us that I believe make them so eminently eligible for the racial death penalty, although certainly not the only one. Okay, well, you may ask, does this long digression have a point? Yes. I said a while ago I wanted to talk about burnout. I mean the total and complete disillusionment of a white nationalist with the cause and the final surrender, the final abandonment of any effort to change anything. I want to talk about the slippage of a white soul into the pit of despair. I want to talk about a white man or woman's final collapse down onto the sofa, only this time they never get up. This time, they fall into that six-pack and they drown. And I mean that quite literally. An amazing lot of those who leave the movement permanently become hopeless alcoholics, if indeed the bottle wasn't a large part of their problem before. You see, what I don't think a lot of people understand is that you can't ever leave the movement. Not really. You can cancel all your publication subscriptions. You can close down all your racial email addresses. You can remove your racist websites from your favorites list, and you can shut down your old Facebook site and maybe set up another bland one that's got nothing but pictures of you and your dog on it. But what you can't ever do is re-plug yourself into the television and the system and move on like nothing ever happened. Because the fact is that once you do unplug yourself from the Soma, pardon the Brave New World reference, the connection is broken forever and it can't ever be reestablished. Once your mind slips the leash and that little puppy starts running around and pissing on the Jews' fire hydrants, you can't ever get him fully leashed and under control again. Once you know, you can't not know any longer. Once you know what's wrong, or to be blunt, once you know about the Jews, you can never erase that knowledge from your brain. It's there for good. You can sit down on that sofa and force yourself to stare at that television set like a Homer Simpson clone. But when the end credits roll, you're still going to notice and count all the Jewish names. Once Pandora's box is opened, the spirits, for good or evil, are out for good. I have known men who have honestly tried to leave, who have really tried to break contact with the movement in every sense of the term. Guys who've tried to put it all behind them and get back into the rat race as if nothing had ever happened. It can't be done. The Jews won't let them do it, and they won't let themselves do it. Once you have done anything at all that has brought you to the notice of the police or the media, once you've been photographed wearing one single swastika or Klan robe or Aryan Nations costume or holding one politically incorrect sign, that's it, you're done. That's you forever in the eyes of society. They never forget and they never forgive. En passant, not only will that photo follow you for the rest of your life, it'll be the worst photo they can take. The one photograph of me that will probably be run with my obituary will be a shot taken of me back in the year 1980 by a Raleigh Times reporter. You probably have all seen it. Anyway, this guy just happened to wander by the old North Street headquarters one day, and I made the mistake of talking to him informally while I was wearing a blue denim golf hat and a bilious green white power t-shirt. And that's it. From now on, that's my photo in life. It makes me look pretty goony, so that's me for all eternity as far as the establishment media goes. I have seen that photo on websites in Russia and newspaper clippings from India. Okay, I need to interrupt this babble with a music break. Our usual theme song on Radio Free Northwest is, of course, The Rising of the Moon by the Irish group Nicosity. But if ever, for any reason, we can't use that one anymore, I think I may have found our alternative theme song for this show. This is Carl Klang.
As Mrs. and Mr. America fret, they huddle around their TV set, they worry and they sweat. They're thinking I'm the enemy, the one they need to get, because their mind controllers tell them I'm a major threat. The talking heads, the daily press, they cultivate stupidity and harvest ignorance. They point a crooked finger and they're all unanimous by calling me extremist, cause I'm down on Zionists. So now I want to sing a new song. I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rousing rebel song and sympathize with the skinnies who realize it was the did the Germans wrong. I want to be an extremist. I want to get the job done. Now what's so bad about being extreme? If I'm extremely innocent, if I'm extremely keen, if I'm extremely paranoid, it's cause of what I've seen. It's written in between the lines of every magazine. The FBI, the CIA are working for the KGB and getting in my way, cause they don't like my politics, they dog me every day. I'm getting tired of telling them the problem is oy vey. The enemy is communism. I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist
and run around and sing the rabble rousing metal song and sympathize with the skinheads who realize it was the Germans wrong and want to be an extremist.
I just want to get the job done.
To know the truth, but all he gets is phony news. His state of mind is captured by the mouth's opposing views. His only guarantee is that he shouldn't be amused. Some may win, but most will lose. Their lives are only figments of the thoughts they cannot choose. And I doubt you'll ever see me on the 6 o'clock news, exposing lying, thieving, cheating communists. Who made me sing you this song? I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and a camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rabble-rabble song and sympathize with the skinheads who realize it was the who did the Germans wrong. I want to be an extremist. I want to get the job done. I want to be an extremist and I just want to have fun. Cha-cha-cha.
One frequent cause of movement burnout is unrealistic expectations when someone first gets involved. One of the hardest and most frustrating and emotionally draining things about any involvement with our kind of alternative politics is the challenge of accepting the movement the way it is in real life, not the way we're portrayed in Hollywood news and entertainment media, and not as we would wish ourselves to be. One of the first things I noticed back with the old party is a problem that we've still got to this day. We live in a media-oriented society, and not everybody understands that what the media tells us isn't necessarily the truth. In fact, more often than not, it's not the truth. Our media stereotype is that so-called, quote-unquote, white supremacists are basically violent maniacs who shoot people and engage in cartoonish James Bond supervillainy. This is one reason I wrote the Northwest novels, to try and portray what actual white freedom fighters might be like in real life, should we ever decide that we want to revolt, as someday we may do. But for the time being, there are a lot of people who get involved with us because of that very bizarre media stereotype of cartoon villains, and not in spite of it. A lot of young white people these days have genuine difficulty in distinguishing between what's real and what's on the various electronic screens that they sit in front of. They think they're getting in on a cartoon or an action movie or a video game or something of the kind, and they find the reality disappointing and rather boring. I run into this phenomenon a lot with my Northwest novels. Now, you guys are going to think I'm making this up when I tell you this, but it's true. I get emails all the time from white people who have somehow gotten the idea that the Northwest novels are real, and the NVA is real, and that we got some kind of armed insurrection going on here in the Northwest. It reminds me of J.K.R. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter novel series, who to this day keeps getting pathetic letters and emails from kids who want to go to Hogwarts and become wizards. We're portrayed on TV and in the movies as these well-organized, conspiratorial people who live in big fancy compounds out in the woods with all kinds of equipment and facilities, and we've got all kinds of private armies or stormtroopers or whatever in uniforms with fully automatic weapons, we've got tanks and maybe genetically engineered dinosaurs in our basement. And we engage in all these bizarre conspiracies to kidnap the president and seize nuclear weapons and use alien technology to wipe out all the niggers in the world. Now, that's Hollywood. That's not us. All that is nothing to do with anything in the real world. It's just an attempt at entertainment and propaganda. And frankly, the movies like that that I've seen aren't even very good. I can't offhand think of one decent movie about our movement that's ever been made by Hollywood. And until we come up with some form of operation we are not amused, and we convey the need for creative balance to those kikes down there in a way that they can't fail to understand, then there won't be any decent or balanced movies ever made about us. Oh, don't I ever wish we had the kind of manpower and money we're portrayed as having in the movies. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Now, when some white people come in and associate themselves with us, I won't say join because you can't really join anything on the internet, sometimes they really do believe that we are what's portrayed by way of so-called white supremacists on television and in Hollywood movies. And when they find out that the truth is vastly different, that's one immediate cause of rapid burnout and disillusionment right there. They come in expecting to find Skeletor or cool vampires or whatever, and instead they find the comic book guy from The Simpsons who's sitting behind a computer 500 miles away and who won't come out because he's scared. Now, if you're expecting cool cartoon villains and then after a while you don't get them, that gets old. These people get bored and the short American attention span kicks in and they wander away in search of different entertainment. And frankly, this is probably the most common form of movement burnout. And it happens fairly quickly. People say, oh, there's nothing happening, you're not doing anything. Unreasonable and unrealistic expectations from the get-go as far as what's possible in the real world. People come in expecting major drama and major entertainment, and then they don't like the show. Now, a subgroup of those people like that is those who are, as Whittaker Chambers once wrote, merely looking for an intellectual night's lodging, or sometimes not just intellectual. We get a lot of people who check us out on the net, and once I explain that there's no compound, no bunkhouse, no refrigerator full of beer, no guaranteed job, no free housing, and no white slacker welfare state for tattooed, shaven-headed mall rats going on up here, they lose interest pretty quick. In real life, the Northwest Front is at present a small group of people who share a common ideal. That's all we're likely to be for the foreseeable future. There are more of us today than there were this time last year, but not as many as there will be this time next year. Other than the small number of people who are, in fact, physically moving to the Northwest homeland, and yes, they do exist, I'm the first to admit that we don't do much of anything except babble to one another on the internet. Like I'm doing tonight, in fact. Unfortunately, that's the reality at the moment. I wish there was more to it than that, and I believe that someday there will be more than that. But if you're looking for fast relief from your racial angst, you ain't gonna find it here. Or anywhere else. Nobody is doing it any better than us. And for the moment, nobody's even pretending to do it any better than us. Now, if you believe the Secret Service, occasionally we do things like conspiring to assassinate Obama while wearing silver sequined white tuxedos and top hats. But that's just made-up nonsense from government secret police who aren't very good at what they do and who have no imaginations. That's nothing to do with reality. I'm doing my very best to change that reality, although I think we'll be able to lose the sequin tuxedos and the top hats. But ironically, all I have to try and make that change with is the internet itself. And so far, I haven't found the magic words, the magic beans, or whatever's needed to make the light bulbs go on over people's heads. Sure, the movement could do much better, but we won't. There is no reason at all why the world that I portray in my Northwest novels, or something very like it, could not become reality. I myself have lived in Ireland, remember, so I know that the situation and the events I describe in my books are very much real-world possibilities. I've seen them and lived them myself, at least on the periphery, and as an observer. Now, some of the things I describe in those books are straight out of the Daily News in Dublin and Belfast from 30 years ago. Leaving all the politics and the ideology aside for the moment, over a period of 30 years, a small group of young white people were able to fight a modern Western democracy, a major world military power, to a standstill. 30 years ago, they were mostly sitting in prison. Today, those who survived are mostly sitting in Stormont in the Westminster and European parliaments, drawing huge salaries of taxpayer money and riding in chauffeured government Mercedes. Okay, maybe that's not the United Ireland they claim to be fighting for, and yeah, they allowed themselves to be bought off. But the fact is that they existed, and they had what it takes to walk the walk. We don't, and that's why my novels are only fiction so far. They need not be fiction forever, but that's your department, not mine. Yes, I know this sounds like I'm rambling again, but what I'm trying to emphasize here is that when people get burned out on the movement, it's not like liberals will claim, because we're banging our heads against the wall year after year trying to accomplish something that can't be accomplished. It has been accomplished on more than one occasion, within living memory. It's happening right now in the Middle East. That is what's so damned enraging about the whole thing. That's what sends me climbing the walls and cursing and clawing. It can be done. We just won't do it. What we want to see happen in this country could be accomplished. And as the conditions in the United States deteriorate every year, a truly revolutionary situation gets closer and easier of achievement. And yet, I know it looks to many of you that nothing ever seems to happen. We never seem to get off the internet at all, and I know it drives some of us so badly up the wall, waiting, 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 year in, year out for something that never seems to happen, that sometimes we throw in the towel. Or we get distracted and we see a nice pretty procession going by and we want to run away and join the circus. We quit, we leave the movement, and we hit the bottle. I'm going to repeat here something that I said last week. Those mobs that you see in Cairo are the result of 30 years of work, blood, sweat, and tears, prison, and suffering behind the scenes on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood. In Libya, it's 40 years worth. I think Gaddafi's been around for about that long. Right now, we in the Northwest Front are finally beginning to lay some of that groundwork in the form of building actual communities of real live people and infrastructure here in the homeland, a task that we should have begun 50 years ago, and that enrages me so much I want to start smashing my microphone against the monitor here. But it is what it is. We have to quit bitching and quit quitting and quit burning out and quit going off and sulking and moaning because of things that happened or didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago. We have to quit screwing around, get to work, get this thing started, and this time do it right. And that's going to take time. Now, I know that's not what you guys want to hear. It's not what I want to hear. It's not what I want to say. But it's all I can say because this is the reality with which we must deal. It wasn't done 50 years ago, and so it has to be done now. And we need to quit pissing and moaning and get on with it. The solution is not to get all depressed and feeling sorry for ourselves and saying, oh, this is never going to work. Oh, Harold isn't doing anything. Nobody's doing anything. Oh, it's so horrible. And then we quit and we wander away and we just pop the top on a six-pack. When that happens, the Jew has won. We've surrendered. The world of the Northwest novels can easily be transformed into reality, but you're going to have to stop reading the novels and start living them. You're going to have to pack the moving vans, come here, form the first small communities and take it from there. That's the first step. Now, that can still happen. It has to. I say again, we only need 1,000. Not that many people. And once a tipping point is reached and the first safety net is established, once the word gets out that there is at least a small herd up here that white boys can hide in, there'll be a mini stampede to the Northwest. The bigger the herd gets and the easier it is for individual whites to hide in it, the more will come. I know, the courage that comes from being in a group together is nigger courage. But in the absence of alpha whites, or the kind that the Jews have bred out of our race, until we can locate and motivate the last few remaining alphas in the world, we have to make do with what we can get. An alpha in this context is what I define as someone who can come here all on his own and off his own bat. Someone who doesn't need a safety net, who doesn't need their hand held, doesn't need a crowd to hide in, doesn't need to be supported, but who supports others, and above all, someone who will do these things, not just can, but will do them. So, in other words, he not only has the character to act, but he has the intelligence to understand that the Northwest is the only remaining way to go. Now, that kind of small but significant migration is, in fact, within the realm of possibility. It's starting to begin now. I'm devoting the rest of my life to ensuring that it does happen, using every idea and every tool that I have. Right now, I'm afraid that's all that's going on. I'm trying to pull a few publicity stunts now. I recently sent out the first press release to our media list, which so far has been ignored. That's going to be the way for quite some time. I'm doing what I can here, folks. But there's no NVA here, no bombs going off, unless you count the bionic backpack in Spokane last month. And that not only didn't go off, but it seems to have been an FBI fabrication. Another cause of burnout is the fact that in real life, the white nationalist movement has virtually no money, which is the first requisite for any kind of success in a materialistic society like America. Now, that also blows a lot of people off. Since Americans are trained from birth, any time they assess a person or an institution or an idea, always to look for signs of money as indicators of success and moral worth. And this goes back to the old 19th century idea of prosperity theology. The idea that God shows his approval of people by rewarding them with material wealth, which is, of course, a very convenient religious viewpoint for rich people. Now, sometimes I hear from movement burnouts who refer to us as quote-unquote losers. You will note that the common term loser that the Jews and the liberals apply to us is the American version of sinner or heretic or whatever in the wider sense. It's most often applied to white males who fail to accumulate material things and wealth. Basically, in this country, if you're not rich and if you're not living a sort of a movie-style existence with, you know, fast cars and cool clothes and all kinds of sexual escapades, you're a quote-unquote loser. In the 21st century, the moral worth and value of both an individual human and an idea is measured on a spreadsheet. A lot of people who become involved with us burn out because they're so deeply depressed by the movement's visible lack of what we've been conditioned from birth to believe are the signs of success, i.e. manifestations of money and the presence of money. Some of these people leave the actual white nationalist movement, insofar as you can leave something that exists only on the internet, and then they go run into somebody who can flash a bit of a role. Sometimes neocons of various kinds, unfortunately. Sometimes they run to somebody like Willis Cardo or some other hard conservative who's been in the business for a long time, or some right-wing guru who holds seminars in rented hotel meeting rooms trying to get at old people's savings by selling them gold and silver coins. There's still a bunch of those around. Or, nowadays, they'll go to the Tea Party, whose people actually do have a little money, so forth and so on. In essence, that's what the Tea Party's all about. These are the few people remaining in society who have any money, and they don't want to hand it over to the niggers and the specs via Obamacare. Anyway, these people who leave our movement for that reason, in essence to seek out a more wealthy patron, so to speak, are doing as they've been conditioned to do as Americans. They're seeking out visible indications of money and success, which unfortunately we don't have and probably won't have in the real movement for a long time. One very bad aspect of life in the movement, as it really is the fact that you simply have to stick with it year in and year out, knowing that most likely there's simply aren't going to be the kind of spectacular developments that I know we all dream of. I've been through a few of those developments, Skokie, Greensboro, and a few other things, and eventually the Northwest Front will get our 15 minutes too. But frankly, the movement is usually rather boring. Now, speaking of boring, it's time for second music break. This is a song from Canada's greatest folk singer, the late Stan Rogers, about a rodeo cowboy who uses his life savings to buy a cattle ranch out in Alberta someplace, but then it turns out he's got a bit of a rustler problem. The song is called Night Guard.
"44's no age to start again, but the bulls were getting tough and he was never free of pain. Where others blew their winnings getting tanked, most of his got banked, saving for the farm. He never thought she'd wait for him at all. She wanted more than broken bones and trophies on the wall. But when he quit and finally got the farm, she ran into his arms, and now they've got a kid. He was star of all the rodeos, but now they rob him blind. It took 18 years of ramaholes and life on the line to get this spread and a decent herd, but now he spends his time pulling night guard. He told her that he'd got it for the game. Winnie 303 with his initials on the frame. Riding in the scabbard at his knee, tonight he's gonna see who's getting all the stock. Seventh one this summer yesterday. Half a year of profits gone and now there's hell to pay. The cops say they know who, but there's no proof. The banker hit the roof and damn near took the car. He was star of all the rodeos, but now they rob him blind. It took 18 years of ramables and life on the line to get this spread and a decent herd, but now he spends his time pulling night guard.
El Creole coming for another load. This time it's not one they take, but two. 2 minutes and they're through and laughing in the cab. And here will be the end of this tonight, 'cause all the proof he needs is lying steady in his sights. It may be just the worst thing he could do, but he squeezes off a few, then makes his call to town. He was star of all the rodeos, but now they rob him blind. It took 18 years of ramables and life on the line. Just spread in a decent herd, but now he's doing time, pulling nine gone. He was star of all the rodeos, but now they rob him blind. It took 18 years of ramables and life on the line. Just spread in a decent herd, but now he's doing time, pulling nine gone.
Okay, now I'm going to get really serious for a bit here. I've already complained on repeated prior occasions that the movement consists almost entirely of internet. And I don't like talking about or responding to internet stuff because, in my view, it's not real. And if you devote too much time to it, you're validating what is, in essence, a fake, kind of like those Hollywood movie sets of frontier towns they used to use in spaghetti westerns that have all the facade out on the street, the saloon and the jail and the hotel and the blacksmith shop and so forth and so on, but behind the frontage, it's just scaffolding and timbers. But something has come up regarding the internet that I think we all need to be aware of, because I think it's something that almost all of us are going to experience if we haven't already. On February the 19th, an article appeared on Fox News that discusses something I think we all know to be true, and that is that the United States government is messing with our internet, i.e. intruding trolls and false identities onto white nationalist sites, using false IDs and IP addresses and internet handles for the purpose of information gathering and disruption. They are indeed inserting trolls into all kinds of alternative websites and boards and also such things as Facebook in order to, quote-unquote, create consensus. That's their term, not mine. Now, I won't read the full article out, and I won't read the URL out either, although if anyone's interested, I'll send them the original article. But it begins like this. The United States government is offering private intelligence companies contracts to create software to manage fake people on social media sites and create the illusion of consensus on controversial issues. The contract calls for the development of quote-unquote persona management software, which would help the user create and manage a variety of distinct fake profiles online. The job listing was discussed in recently leaked emails from the private security firm H.B. Gary after an attack by an internet activist late last week. According to the contract, the software would protect the identity of government agencies by employing a number of false signals to convince users that the poster is in fact a real person. A single user could manage unique background information and status updates for up to 10 fake people from a single computer. Well, this is Fox News I'm reading from now. Quote, the software enables the government to shield its identity through a number of different methods, including the ability to assign unique IP addresses to each persona and the ability to make it appear as though the user is posting from other locations around the world. The document describes how they would friend real people on Facebook as a way to convey government messages. Okay, I'm not just going to keep on reading an article out here, but y'all get the idea. This isn't the first time that the government's been exposed doing stuff like this. In January 2010, it was revealed, again through a leaked series of emails, that a Jew in the White House named Cass Sunstein, who at that time had some kind of innocuous title like Deputy Communications Director, was running a program called Cognitive Dissonance, which basically used trolls using false identities to infiltrate and disrupt alternative websites. Specifically our kind of sites, and also 9/11 truth sites. I won't read out any URLs on that either, but you guys can just Google Cass Sunstein and you'll see what comes up. The Anti-Defamation League and the Israeli Mossad, among others, have admitted on several occasions in the past that they run a number of professional trolls whose mission is to gather intelligence and also to disrupt and spread confusion and disinformation on white internet groups and bulletin boards. Now, in short, this is nothing new. I'm sure that those of us who regularly frequent certain white nationalist websites and V-bulletin boards, and who have observed certain kinds of bizarre posts, seemingly pointless flame wars over nothing, and apparently demented behavior, have wondered whether or not this was just ordinary internuts letting it all hang out, or whether the individual in question was part of some kind of overall program of covert government infiltration and disruption to make us all look like Fruit Loops. And before anyone makes the obvious point, yes, I am painfully aware of the fact that it's almost impossible to tell with movement people whether they're acting on some kind of hidden agenda, or else they're simply assholes and loons. Now remember, I'm the movement's official Mr. Character issue. You don't have to tell me that a lot of our so-called comrades are cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. However, in some especially egregious cases, I'm sure the thought has crossed all our minds at one point or another that, hey, this person is just plain acting too nutty to be really nutty. He seems fairly intelligent, or he did for a while when he first came on the group and he was feeling his way and working his way in, so to speak, before he suddenly went bananas, and he has to be aware of the overall effect that his little hissy fit here on the internet has on the tone of the website and the way it makes white nationalism look to other people. He has to get that, so why is he doing this? Now, we think to ourselves that no one who really cares about the white nationalist movement would knowingly make an ass out of himself like this. This has to be some kind of black op or deliberate disruption attempt. Well, judging from what the regime itself has now admitted in the earlier Sunstein case and the persona management software case I just cited above, I'd say now that there is a better than even chance that some of these assholes we see throwing a hissy fit on Stormfront or in the comments section of some blog really are government black operators. Matter of fact, I suspect that some of the operators of some of these blogs are black operators. Bluntly put, we can no longer trust that anything we see on Stormfront or VNN or Facebook is legitimate. We have to analyze every internet post we read in the light of, does this make sense? Does this help the 14 words or hurt it? And last but not least, who is this person who made this post? Who is signing his checks? So, what can we do about it? Frankly, not much. I do, however, have a modest suggestion that I'd like to just throw out there, running up the flagpole and see if anybody salutes. I'm going to speak in a very general way here, and I'm not going to name anybody, since that apparently is what gets people really upset when I name names, which is a whole other psychological ball of wax, but we won't get into that. I think that all white nationalists who use the internet, meaning damn near all of us, need to step back and take a good long look at the issue of anonymity on the white internet with a view toward reducing it and in some cases stigmatizing and rejecting it. Now, frankly, for a long time, there have been entirely too many anonymous people shouting the odds on the internet, as we used to say in Rhodesia. People telling us what's what and who's who and who we should listen to and who we shouldn't. People who pop up in certain threads and on certain boards and who attempt to seize control of the conversation and direct the discourse and shout down anyone who disagrees. People claiming some kind of white racial political expertise, but no one knows quite why or from where such expertise is obtained. People whom no one knows, period, beyond an email handle or a Facebook page or an anonymous blog. People who could, for all we know, really be the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from the Temple Schmuck El. Now, this is by no means a good thing. Many of you will have some experience of this phenomenon on Stormfront or VNN, just to name two of the more popular examples. Now, certain individuals on those boards clearly have no agenda other than stirring shit and causing disruption and demoralization, as well as, of course, trying to alienate people from the Northwest Imperative, the only actual plan to resist that the movement's ever been able to come up with. And yet they are inexplicably allowed to continue with this destructive behavior by the moderators. Now, in all too many cases, they are moderators. They ban intelligent and thoughtful posters, and they seem to do everything they can to turn a potentially invaluable forum, a means of communication for our people and a propaganda weapon for white survival, into a raving loony bin. Well, In view of the Sunstein revelation of last year, and in view of today's Fox News article talking about government trolls with multiple personas, I think we need to start coming to grips with the high degree of likelihood that a lot of what we see on our favorite V bulletin board and a lot of what we see on Facebook and other social networking sites and a lot of these blogs that we are obsessed with may be flat out government deception. I know I shouldn't be encouraging paranoia, but paranoia is an unjustified fear of surveillance or persecution. And it's starting to look like a lot of my questions about certain email and internet IDs and their activities for some years past may in fact be justified. Paranoids have enemies too, you know. Now, by way of full disclosure here, I want to admit up front that both I personally and the Northwest Front have been cyberstalked for a number of years by the same three individuals. Those of you who email me asking me, "Harold, why does everybody on the internet say bad things about you?" need to bear in mind that quote-unquote everybody doesn't say bad things about me. Judging by writing styles and script contents and general behavioral patterns, I've come to the conclusion that 90% of the internet crap about me is the work of three separate people, two of whose identities I know perfectly well, even though they hide behind phony email names and proxy servers and whatnot. One of them is my brother, I'm sorry to say, and in his case, his problems are personal and have nothing to do with race or politics, no matter what he gibbers on blogs. The other is a guy some of you have had the misfortune to meet in the past, and he's just a nut who only talks about one thing. I just ignore him. Now, the third individual, the guy with the most internet identities, I think may actually be a cognitive dissonance agent of some kind. Because he follows me all over the internet, anywhere I appear in the comments section of a blog or a media news article or anything of the kind, and he always follows the same script, just under several different names. And when I went on Facebook, he appeared there under yet another name, but using the same script. I understand that many white people have legitimate reasons for remaining anonymous on the net in the form of real-world jobs and families that they have to protect. I get that, believe me. They have every right to post. No one's denying that. They do not have a right to lead, insofar as that term can be applied to anything on the internet, which I admit isn't very far. They do not have a right to disrupt, spread rumors, spread disinformation, and do nothing but stir while using false names and not letting anyone get a look at them so as to assess what their true motivation is. Now, when someone pops up and starts shouting the odds, spreading rumors, attacking the only viable plan that the white resistance has yet managed to produce in order to combat our existential crisis, and deliberately targeting specific people and ideas in an internet-wide stalking campaign, it is entirely legitimate that we demand that these people step forward in every sense of the term and let us get a look at them so that their words can be properly evaluated and placed in a context and their credibility scrutinized. Our internet discussion, useless as most of it is not merely academic. It concerns the survival of our race and our civilization, and it's far too important to treat lightly. Now, it's an unfortunate but incontestable fact that in our movement, because of our character issues, we always have to look closely not only at the message but at the man. Now, that's just the way it is. Now, if someone offers or claims to lead us, even if only in opinion and discourse on a computer monitor, then we have every right to demand that they let us get a look at them and that we be allowed to know who he is, where he has been, what his track record is, who he hangs with, and who he has hung with on the internet and otherwise, what his true agenda is, and who is signing his checks. Yes, I know this is completely unenforceable. The only way we can counteract this kind of deliberate disruption from the enemy, which I repeat, is taking place, they've admitted it now in the public media, the only way that we can counteract this is to look closely at every post in the light of two things. Number one, overall effect. Is a person's presence on the group positive or negative? Do they unite or do they divide? Secondly, is this person anonymous? Does anyone know who they are in real life? Has anyone met them personally? Can anyone vouch for them? And if the answer to these questions is no, then there needs to be some kind of credibility rating system that we all need to agree on to let others know that from now on in our movement, an anonymous voice is no longer an authoritative voice. And if someone wants to persuade or convince you about someone else, but won't let you know who they themselves are, you need to ask why. Okay, time for a little male chauvinist piggery in a musical sense here. This song is called The Trooper and the Maid, and it celebrates a one-night stand that took place many centuries ago somewhere in Scotland. I don't think our female listeners will find it too offensive, because I don't think anyone's going to be able to understand the dialect. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
A triple lad came here in next we ride, and he was weary. A triple lad came here in next when the moon shone bright and clearly. She ta'en the trooper by the horn and led him to her chamber. Gave him cheese and wine to drink, and a wine it was like amber.
And a wine it was like amber.
Bonnie lassie, all I need you know. Bonnie lassie, all I need ye. I'll get all your ribbons reeled in the morning and I'll leave ye. She'd made a bed bit lying and white, made it like a lady. 10 or 40 hours of heat, said triple lad, get ready. Bonnie lassie, all I need you know. Bonnie lassie, all I need you. I'll get all your ribbons reeled in the morning and I'll need you. Been but an hour in bed, an hour and half a quarter, when drums come beating up the street and every beat was shorter. Bonnie lassie, all I need you know. Bonnie lassie, all I need ye. I'll get all your ribbons reeled in the morning and I'll leave ye. And when will you come back again, my dear soldier laddie? When will you come back again and be your Benny's daddy? Bonnie lassie, I'm and leave you now. Bonnie lassie, I'm and leave ye. When heather bells grow cockle shells, then I'll come and see ye. She'd ta'en her coatie out of heed and followed him up to Stirling. Gracie Poole, she took me boo, he left her in Dunfermline. Bonnie lassie, I'll I need you now. Bonnie lassie, I'll I need ye. I'll get all your ribbons reeled in the morning and I'll leave ye. Lassie, I'll I need you now. Bonnie lassie, I'll I need ye. I'll get all your ribbons in the morning and I'll leave ye.
Now, for a complete reversal of my normal order for this program, I want to close with an Edgar Steele update. I just heard from Ingrid Castle, and she says that Edgar Steele has been moved to the Bonner County Jail in Sandpoint, Idaho. The U.S. Marshals moved him after his bail hearing, wherein Mrs. Steele offered to put up their house and all their property for the bond. A local friend offered Edgar Steele to stay at his house if he couldn't be released to his home to work on his defense. The motion was denied, of course. His trial is still set for March the 7th. Apparently, the rules at the Bonner County Jail are much better than the ones at the Spokane Federal Lockup, and Ed's finally allowed to receive actual letters, not just postcards. I'll be posting that address on our several blogs within the next 24 hours or so. Okay, tonight, like I said, we'll actually close out with the emails instead of begin with them. Dear HAC, I've spoken with my son about moving to the homeland. His name is Jack. He's 13, and he's on board with the program. He asked me an interesting question tonight, and I thought I might pass it on to you. He's very much a fan of the Third Reich, and asked if there might be a similar organization for boys his own age modeled on the Hitler Youth. What are your thoughts on pre-revolutionary organizing of young boys and girls, the children of those who come to the homeland? I haven't heard you address this topic in the past, and thought it might make for some thought-provoking commentary. Mark from Illinois. Well, dear Mark and Jack, yes, of course we'll have youth organizations in the Northwest Republic. Some white version of the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts will be vitally necessary, to be blunt, as the beginning of military training, if for no other purposes. The fact is that in the next section of Northwest Novel No. 5, entitled Freedom's Sons, I'm going to mention such youth organizations in connection with the defense of the Republic from an invasion. Now, as to whether we need to organize these groups before the revolution itself, well, when we have enough people living in our communities and we have enough boys and girls of the appropriate age, I would say yes. Right now, frankly, that's a problem we don't have to face. We do have some children of the appropriate age among some of our party people here, but unfortunately, we're still pretty scattered and still pretty far apart, and it wouldn't be practical right at the moment. But yes, once we get a community set up in Kalispell or Salem or Spokane or Ellensburg or wherever, and if they've got enough children to want to do something like that, yeah, let's roll on it. Dear HAC, I'm in the planning stages of making a move to the Northwest. It's a tough sell to my girlfriend, but I'm hoping that in time I can persuade her and that this is the best thing for us as a family. We have a 16-month-old son, and we're expecting a daughter in May. I can't take the gap without my family, so getting her to get on board may take some time. I can be quite persuasive when I put my mind to it, so please don't count me out. Anyhow, I know relatively little about the Pacific Northwest. I have been doing as much research as I can to educate myself, but some things are more difficult to find than others. For example, what is the most white suburb of Seattle or Portland? This information will be helpful for me when job searching. Also, I wanted to follow up to see if you received a letter from me. Hope so. If you did, I hope to send more of those as time goes on and have like-minded friends contribute. Thank you again for the Northwest Quartet. Do you have any estimate on the release date for Sons of Freedom? Best wishes, Corey, in... Is that Massachusetts? Michigan? I can't remember now. Something begins with an M. Okay, first off, Corey, it's Freedom's Sons, and I hope to have Section 1 available within a week, which will be about 75,000 words. I presently plan for the book to have 5 sections, and I'll be publishing it section by section on the internet and in other places in order to make sure that if anything happens to me between now and the time I complete the novel, I'll at least get what I've got of it out there. Regarding your main question about Seattle and Portland, to be blunt, I recommend that unless there is a pressing need for you to work in Seattle or Portland, you try to avoid the actual cities as much as possible. Smaller metropoli right now like Kalispell, Salem, Coeur d'Alene, and a few other places are most likely better for a family. No kidding, Portland and Seattle really suck. What you don't tell me about is your skills. Now, I need to know more about exactly what kind of work you're looking for, and I'll also discuss primary settlement areas with you if you will email me privately at nwnet@earthlink.net. Next email, dear Mr. Covington, do you believe in flying saucers? Signed, John in Iowa. That's a real email, by the way. Yes, John, as a matter of fact, I do, because there's simply too much evidence that something's flying around up there. Having said that, I can't see any way that such things are germane to the racial struggle unless the aliens land one day and offer to help us off the niggers and the kikes. Think anything about them, really. Dear Mr. Covington, where can I order a Northwest tricolor flag from? Signed, Jeremy in Missouri. Jeremy and others, you can order a high-quality homemade tricolor from our flag maker, Comrade Steve. Contact me at nwnet@earthlink.net or through the website, and I'll send you the details. The next email comes from an idiot. I get a lot of emails from idiots, and this one is pretty typical. Dear racist bastard, so forth and so on, we will never let you have your own country here in the Northwest. Well, you don't say just who we is, but whoever you are, I guess it's a good thing that we have no intention of asking your permission to make our own homeland here. Now, isn't it? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.